Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest today is Eli Merritt, author of Disunion Among Ourselves, The Perilous Politics of the American Revolution. Eli is a political historian at Vanderbilt University who specializes in the founding era of the United States and the intersection of demagogues and democracy. And welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Great to be with you, Hopeton.
The intersection of demagogues and democracy. This must be a very fertile time for your study of history.
Absolutely. I do think that's an important way to think of it. I would say that my interest in the founding period of the United States definitely intersects in many ways with my interest in demagogues and democracy. But it really came to full force in, for me, it was about 2018. I finally concluded that the president of the United States was a demagogue. And I began to study that topic in great detail, more in history than anywhere else. And what you find there is the other talk I'm giving, other than the book talk with frequency now and expect to for the next year, is called Alexander Hamilton's Theory of Democratic Collapse. A president commences a demagogue and ends a tyrant. So all history demonstrates that demagogues in high positions of power, we all know the concept of power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So demagogues are very, very susceptible to being corrupted into authoritarianism. And we've had a dangerous and scary case study of that in this country over the past 7 years. So yeah, they're two separate things, but the history of demagogues is that George Washington was afraid of demagogues in 1787 when he was at the Constitutional Convention. So that finding was one of the triggers or sparks that helped me to go down the road of continued study of demagogues and democracy.
Well, one of the important things about this book is when I think about what I learned about the American Revolution, the war with Great Britain, what I remember is the struggle without. So we struggled against the British. That's sort of the narrative that runs through my mind. What you have brought to the forefront is the struggle within the sectional conflict between the New England states, the middle states, or the New England colonies, the middle colonies, and the southern colonies. And I think what your book does remind us today is that this heated conflict between different sections of our country, or maybe in the case today, different ideologies in our country, this is nothing new to American democracy. So how important do you think it is that people understand that this heated conflict between different sections of the country is an old song?
Yeah, I'll say about the first point that you brought up, I do think that probably the most important revelation of the book is, in a way, it says there's some things we get wrong about our understanding of the American Revolution. It's exactly what you said. Most people comprehend that the greatest danger or fear of the founders during the American Revolution was the power and might of the British Army and Navy. And while certainly that was deeply intimidating, the greatest fear they had was that they would fall into conflict themselves in their government of the time, which was called the Continental Congress. And they feared that they would fall into terrible conflict and that would lead them to split apart naturally, I'll say, into separate confederations. And the problem there was that for many reasons, they were certain that if they broke apart into separate confederations, they would fall into civil wars. They were convinced they would fall into civil wars over finances, commerce, and most hugely over land. And there were also there weren't necessarily predictions that one side was going to launch a civil war against the other for the emancipation of enslaved peoples, but certainly it was feared that if civil war took place between those separate confederations, that the enslaved people in the South, in some areas up to 40% of the population, were certainly going to rise up for their freedom as well. So on the second point, you know, why is it important for us to understand this? You know, in some ways, as a historian, I just like to discover new things and write about it. And is it salutary to discover this or not salutary? I think in the end, it is salutary because it helps us to understand that the American experiment has been a tremendous challenge, not only since whenever one would want to start at the 1850s before the Civil War or before the Civil Rights Movement, But it's been a deep challenge to unite this country of very diverse regions since the very beginning. And that it's tremendous to me, to be honest with you, that all of the predictions in the founding era of the coming of disunion and civil war, it's tremendous that they had that implicit or unconscious or conscious fear back then. And we see that it came to fruition. And after the Civil War, for all the tragedy that it represents, the nation gained primarily the emancipation of enslaved people, but it also finally settled the deep question, is it okay for one or more states to secede from the Union? That was an open question from 1774 until the end of the Civil War. So I do think it's deeply important or deeply helpful to us to understand this history of the American Revolution and the founding period.
The book is largely chronological. You open up in 1774 with the four coercive acts, the Continental Congress, and you close with a letter from George Washington, his farewell address. And one of the things that you open up with at the very beginning, going back to your discussion about the fear of domestic civil war, is that Joseph Galloway, Speaker of the Pennsylvania House, you write, proved to be the most anxious delegate of all to attend the first Congress. He foresaw American disobedience as a certain pathway, not only to the coming of a destructive imperial civil war with England, but also to several species of domestic civil war. And what you document throughout the book is so many different people were fearful of that. That wasn't just a boy crying wolf.
And that's part of that remarkable capacity of people to predict the future. And of course, often it's incorrect, but it's remarkable how correct it is. Or maybe that's how we go about studying history, as we're looking for those predictions. That's part of it, I think, too, is the sort of the historian's gaze. But Galloway, is that example is remarkable. There's many examples of the prediction of the coming of civil war that's remarkable. Galloway, in particular, in 1775, was counseling the other delegates in the Continental Congress, do not launch into independence. This is far too dangerous. He actually was actively involved in trying to draw up a constitution between the British Parliament and the 13 colonies that would expand their powers tremendously, but would keep them united to Great Britain, to the king, and to the Parliament there, because he really viewed that it was critical for the 13 colonies to have a supreme arbitrating power over them. And he specifically said, as we've begun to discuss, he specifically said that you need this because otherwise you are going to kill one another. You folks sitting in here in the First Continental Congress who think we'll rise up for our liberty, you're going to end up killing one another. And his remarkable prediction was, I don't know how all this is going to come out, but I'm going to put a guess out there. He said, I think at some point there will be a massive civil war between the North and the South. And he said the North is going to win for reasons we could go into. The South was pretty weak and vulnerable for many reasons. But he specifically also said, bear in mind, there is a dangerous enemy within the bowels of the Southern colonies. And by that, he meant enslaved peoples. And he was implying that, as we touched on earlier, they were going to rise up in some ways and join any Northern army that was trying to defeat the Southern colonies in pursuit of their own freedom. I'll just touch on briefly, that was not the only sense of geographical split that was predicted. Another delegate, or several delegates early in the Congress, I'm not in the middle, not at the end, predicted that what was going to happen is the 13 colonies were going to unite for this war. And shortly after the War of Independence, if it was successful, New England, the powerhouse of the 4 to 5 New England states, they would be called at that time, they were going to be a bit unsettled, you know, uniting with these other colonies because they didn't want to compromise or states. And they were going to break off and form their own confederation. And that sounds, oh, well, they could peacefully do that. And we would have basically two or three different countries in what is now called the United States. They were certain that New England was not going to rest militarily or diplomatically until it gained entire control over the Hudson River, which was entirely in the state of New York. So there would be many predictions of civil war taking place at the Hudson River, more so even than frank civil war between the North and the South. So there's other creative divisions of the states in civil wars and fears, but the dominant one was at the Hudson River.
For those of us who don't remember all the different ways all these different states were formed, or at least these different colonies were formed, the sources of the where the people came from, how did we end up with such cultural differences between these regions? Briefly, if you could talk about where the people were coming from and the customs they adopted that made these colonies so different.
I would say that you're right. It's important to recognize that the dominant influxes of individuals, immigrants, into New England and somewhat into the four middle colonies, later middle states, and the southern colonies were of different origins. In New England, we understand that you had the influx of Puritans, later described as Congregationalists, and they had forms of government that were, I'm focusing on New England right now, that important to understand, vastly more nearly democratic than by far the middle states and the southern states, were, which were both considered to be in their own ways quite aristocratic. So New England, I actually, in many ways, give the most thanks in terms of the origins of our country for New England, for many reasons. I don't think our country, I don't know what the history would have been without New England. I mean, I hate to predict that we could still have aristocracy and not slavery by this point, but they came in with incredible values of Republican government and ultimately Democratic government, which at that time was greatly feared as one of the most dangerous forms of government, democracy. But I think the most important point to make here that created our history, not only in the 1770s and 1780s, but thereafter, is the introduction of slavery into the southern colonies in the 17th century, which has been, you know, I think wonderfully highlighted by the 1619 project. So if people are looking at a date to say, well, wait a minute, when did the colonies become so distinct and perhaps irreconcilable in terms of their ability to politically problem solve? It would be in 1619 with the introduction of slavery. And it's interesting, if not important, to understand as well that there's a deep sense that slavery was introduced into the southern colonies, not necessarily at the instigation of the few, at that time, the few southern settlers who were there, but the British Parliament was very interested itself, was very exploitative, and it was looking at the ways that it could derive the greatest economic, greatest trade gains from the colonies. And so I think it's fascinating that Thomas Jefferson lived most of his life very upset that slavery had ever been introduced into the 13 colonies. Any particular, maybe there was some sense of displacing his own guilt, but very upset at the British Parliament and the British merchants for ever having introduced slavery into the southern states and thus poisoning them for, in his view, all eternity. So those are some, I think the introduction of slavery is the most significant cultural, economic, and moral difference that took place in the 1770s.
And you do write that this union among ourselves cast light on the most tragic aspect of the revolution. That is, how did the purportedly enlightened founders, especially Jefferson, possibly perpetuate the crime of slavery during the war years and thereafter, in spite of the institution's roaring contradictions with the ideas of liberty and freedom that inspired the war 3 centuries later, we are still confused and angered by the hypocrisy of their decisions. Because when you look at, for example, one of the things I like to talk about is who could vote at the beginning of this country. So only people, white males that owned property, could vote at the very beginning of this country. So sometimes when I look at the beginning of this country, it was a very, very, very imperfect democracy. And was it really democracy at that point in time? I mean, it was very limited democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was it was certainly representative government, but to your point, who was being represented? I recently saw a statistic. I don't want to send it out as verified because I haven't really dug deep into it, but that it was 3% of the population that could vote at that time as a rough estimate that someone has made. But obviously the question that I think haunts our nation the most is what you brought up is how did these folks the white founders who were enlightened. I mean, they were avid students of Enlightenment history and Enlightenment philosophy. And obviously they advocated equality of humans and liberty. How did they possibly perpetuate slavery, not only after the American Revolution, but thereafter until the Civil War intervened to resolve the problems in some ways, at least the status of enslaved people. And that's an important part of the talk that I've been giving. And I'm a great fan, not of simplistic history, of one single ideology in our minds that explains things. I think it's actually very counterproductive and leads to tribalism and righteousness. But I think what's important to understand, and what my book really introduces into historical circles that's most significant, is an interpretive lens on the founding of the country and the history of the country called the survivalist interpretation. And so I would suggest there's probably more than three interpretations that explain why the founders perpetuated slavery. There's probably more, but the three that I discuss the most. The first, I think we understand certainly better than the survivalists, which I'll touch on. But the first interpretation we can just call the white supremacist or systemic racism interpretation for why the founders perpetuated slavery. And that's because there was a built-in caste system and there was racial superiority. So that's one interpretive lens. The other interpretive lens, which is very commonly understood as well, we can consider to be the economic interpretation for why the founders perpetuated slavery. And that is the Southern economy, definitely heavily dependent upon slave trade and slave labor to keep its economic engines running. But then also people also understand that the North was implicated as well, because its economy in many ways also depended strongly on both slave labor and slavery. And then the last that I introduce that I think is quite important as well is the survivalist interpretation. And essentially it is that the founders of the country felt politically trapped to perpetuate slavery by this dynamic, which is if at any point a Northern contingency or a Northern state in 1770s, 1780s, 1790s had come in and just said, look, we've made a decision here that slavery is clearly incompatible with the values of the country, the values of the Enlightenment, the values of the Declaration of Independence. So we actually are going to, by the 1790s, it would have been disunited, but 1770s, 1780s, they said, we are just simply not going to form a single political unity or country with you Southern colonies unless you agree at least to a plan, gradual plan for emancipating slaves or for and for ending the slave trade. Well, what would have happened then? It is certain. Historical evidence is unambiguous on this. One or more of the Southern states would have seceded from the Union if that demand had been placed on them with regard to the slave trade or slavery. They would have formed a separate confederation, and they would have fought civil war between themselves, either civil wars or a civil war. So in the book, I call it a sad devil's bargain, meaning it was existential problem on both sides from the viewpoint of the white founders, the existential crime of humanity against slaves posited against for them the certainty of coming civil war if there was a demand placed on the federal government to end slavery. So in some ways they chose freedom from civil wars themselves over even a gradual plan for passing along the rewards of the Declaration of Independence to enslaved people. So all three interpretations are correct. I actually think with my introduction of the survivalist interpretation, we get even a little closer to understanding why the founders perpetuated slavery. It was a multidimensional causation. And I actually think, and hope to be interesting to hear your opinion, I think one of the most important things that we have over the next several decades to study and to understand is the history of slavery in our country. And of course, my preference is to engage in those researches and debates in a very passionate way, but also a way that is not ultimately polarizing and tribal. So I plan to continue to discuss, particularly as we're approaching in several years, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. There's more and more opportunities we're approaching this for divisive conflict, but I would prefer for us to have some conflict, certainly, but also more opportunity to expand our thinking outward to complex history instead of simplistic history. And I'll say just finally, one of the reasons I think complex history is so important is it matures us as individuals and also helps us to mature as a democracy.
Well, I think when it comes to our acceptance of simplistic history, it's simply because we don't have the bandwidth to do a deep dive into everything. So one of the things I talked to my 17-year-old daughter about is you can't be an expert in everything, but anything that you feel passionate about, you have to do the deep dive, that you have to look at the complexity of that issue to better understand it if you're going to talk and be engaged passionately with it. One of my favorite subjects, for example, is the relationship between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. You know, the simplistic look at it is that they were in opposition. The reality is that W.E.B. Du Bois sent a telegram to Booker T. Washington after he made the Atlanta Compromise speech congratulating him for that speech, which would probably be shocking to anybody who looks at the simplistic view of the relationship between the two, or the fact that Booker T. Washington twice tried to hire W.E.B. Du Bois to work for him at Tuskegee Institute, that when Booker T. Washington got his PhD from Harvard, that Booker T. Washington tried to hire him, but he had accepted a professorship at another university. And so understanding the complexity of that relationship, when I did my deep dive into it and why they ultimately became vigorous opponents, and understanding the complexity, say, of Booker T. Washington, who publicly appeared to accept separate but equal, but in the reality was funding legal cases to fight separate but equal. But because of his relationships, for example, with Andrew Carnegie and the people that were supporting him, the robber barons of the day, he couldn't be outward and public about his opposition to segregation. So I think part of the issue today is people deciding that we don't want to just engage in discussions of the myths of today, as there seems to be this real big push to erase our past, or not to talk about the seedier versions of our past, but to really be engaged, to have truthful discussions. Most countries have difficult pasts. All nations have difficult pasts. All nations have these tribal differences, these conflicts, some genocide. If you study it, it's just sort of it. But what I like to say is I live in the United States of America. So my focus is on the United States of America. So I think that discussion can be had. But also I think it's the recognition of many of the powers that be that, for example, try to make critical race theory as if Black history was critical race theory, which the little I know about critical race theory, Derrick Bells, the legal scholar that was part of the invention of it, Black history is not critical race theory. So I think that's discussion can be held, but I think it would take me to what George Washington said. He said, sustaining a single government, and I'm paraphrasing, for the purpose of safeguarding liberties and rights and keeping the peace required comity, not sure I pronounced that correctly, it's a word I actually never use, and goodwill among the people in the states. This disposition of heart, he said, was one of the vital pillars of American independence. And I think today there is a lack of an attempt to have comity and goodwill. Yeah. And my history of it looks at Newt Gingrich and what he brought to the table when he became Speaker of the House and how he encouraged this incredibly divisive take on the Democrats by the Republicans. Now, I'm sure, and that's the history I know, but I bet there's other history. Like Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, when you look at when they ran against each other for presidents, I don't think we realize as a country, if you go back and read, they were throwing bombs at each other. I mean, that just incredibly divisive language actually was there at the very beginning of the country. So sorry about going off on a little tangent here.
No, I actually just want to hold into not the tangent, but the things you have said, because I'm already of the opinion that the most important thing that has been said today was said by you, and it is in relationship to the guiding principle that you're giving your daughter. And I think we need to repeat that. The guiding principle that we should all have is not, you don't necessarily, I'm just repeating because it's so worthwhile, you don't necessarily need to do a deep dive into all aspects of history, but I'm going to remember this. If you feel very passionately about something in history, it is going to mean necessarily that you get a little narrow-minded about that, because passion makes us quite narrow-minded. So therefore, to repeat your guiding principle, whenever you feel passionately about something in history, you're going to do yourself and your friends and your family and your nation a great favor by doing a deep dive when you feel passionate about something. So that is a very, very worthwhile concept. And that idea of comity, which I agree is a tricky word, it can sound like comedy, but it's not C-O-M-I-T-Y. I do believe that would be the goal that in history, in the discussion of history, that we can passionately disagree and debate. But of course, we don't need to engage in demagoguery or ad hominem attacks, all of these things that break us down as people. But we need this comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, ultimately as a glue that's holding us together, or civic virtue, to use a more old-fashioned term, that is the glue that's holding us together in our political discussions, in our cultural discussions, and also in our things that are now being described as history wars. So I really appreciate you saying that about that. Whenever there's passion, to repeat for the third time, so I never forget, when there's passion, we need to do the deep dive in history.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the surprising things I learned in this book. One was the Mississippi River navigation conflict. New England wanted the rights to fisheries in Newfoundland. The Southern states wanted the ability to navigate the Mississippi River. The British, with the Treaty of 1763, I guess that was after the French Indian War, got the right to navigate the Mississippi River. That was critical to commerce for the South. And at one point, New England was negotiating, I think, a treaty with Spain or France, and I don't recall which one. And they were willing to sacrifice the Mississippi River navigation that the Southern colonies wanted in favor of what they were trying to get in terms of New England being able to access Newfoundland. So talk a little bit about, for me, that was, and then here's the other second thing, it's two things.
Okay.
This claim of land outside of their colonies, all these differing claims of land. And you write that Virginia land secession and intransigence on navigation rights to the Mississippi River almost ended the Union. So this book is about all these different things that could have ended the Union, that it was fortune that the states, the colonies stayed together. But talk a little bit about the Mississippi River navigation, which I understand in the book was one of the first political crisis between the North and the South, and all these different colonies having claims on other land.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the, I think, most untold stories about the founding in general, but it began in the American Revolution, is this contest between the economic interests of New England and the Southern states. And of course, we got the middle states in there, but in some ways it's been well documented, not only by me, but others, that the real dichotomy of during the founding period was New England versus the Southern states. So what I find so fascinating is that when we think of, well, what really was the American Revolution all about? Most people quite logically say, well, X, Y, and Z happened, and it led the 13 colonies to unite and decide we are going to separate from Great Britain, and we're not going to stop fighting until they give us our political and economic independence. For the seaboard, for the 13 seaboard colonies, which are, again, we call them states after the Declaration of Independence. Well, the fascinating piece is this. That was in July of 1776. By December in 1776, it had been made very clear within the Congress, based on issues of foreign affairs, but it had been made very clear that there were, in fact, three objectives of the American Revolution, not just independence, but for the sake of New England, as you made allusion to. They basically said at the end of 1776, we don't plan to lay down arms until we get independence. Plus, critically, we get fishing and drying rights for cod and haddock in the area of the Big Island, the British island of Newfoundland, or either they wanted to conquer it and have it for themselves. Why? Because their economy was so deeply dependent upon that commerce in fish, cod, and haddock. And the Virginia stood up and said, well, us too, we really don't want to lay down arms in the American Revolution until we fulfill our charters, the Southern colonies, Virginia most prominently, And our charter goes all the way across the Appalachian Mountains, all the way across Tennessee, Kentucky, and other states to the Mississippi River. And the critical thing here is the mountains. These mountains were there, meaning every travel was by river. So the rivers on the other side of the mountains, in the what we call the Trans-Appalachian West, all flowed into the Mississippi River. And so at the end of 1776, mainly led by the Virginians, said, we don't want to lay down arms until we get those lands secured from Britain. But then, by the way, we're also going to need navigation rights on the Mississippi River, because what good is land and commerce and crops and tobacco if you can't get it to market? And the key piece there is to understand, a little complicated, but Spain owned the Louisiana Territory at that time and actually had the ability to close the mouth of the river to commerce from an upstart new nation like the United States. So that set up incredible fights. Ultimately, the fight didn't happen in 1776, but by 1779, Spain and Britain were denying that they were going to make the War of Independence also about the Newfoundland fisheries and the navigation of the Mississippi River. Terrible fights. It almost broke apart the Union. But in the end, what happened is they really recognized there was this sectional balance. And if the negotiators for our peace, which began roughly in 1782, ended in 1783, if they had not fought for independence for all, plus fishing and drawing rights for New England in the treaty of 1783, which ended the war, and also for the southern states' navigation of the Mississippi River, it might have broken the Union, because it would have seemed unfair. Imagine this peace treaty coming back. Well, we all got independence, clap. And then New England got fishing rights and drawing rights in Newfoundland, and the southern states did not get their western lands. They did not get at least a show of an attempt to get the navigation of the Mississippi. Could have been big trouble.
I want to talk a little bit about John Adams and specifically the Frankfort Advice. Continental Congress, it appears that the New Englanders were not loved. And so they were advised to not push, as you said earlier, not to push for independence and allow a Virginian to be nominated commander, allow Virginia to be the first to press a motion for independence on the floor of Congress, and allow Virginia Thomas Jefferson to author the Declaration of Independence. There was a lot of concession by Massachusetts to Virginia. Talk a little bit about what was going on there.
There, we again find this dichotomy between New England and the southern colonies or southern states. And the key thing to understand is that Virginia was really the flagship of the southern states or colonies. If Virginia was extraordinarily powerful, the most powerful colony of the 13. So the idea was, if you can get Virginia to come along with the ambitions and motivations of New England or the middle colonies, the other southern colonies will likely follow. So as they were, as New Englanders, Massachusetts, were approaching the First Continental Congress in 1774, a band of middle colony delegates rode out and intercepted them 5 miles outside of Philadelphia in the small town of Frankfort. And they just said, look, we got to tell you some things here. You guys are in the most trouble, because, of course, it was only New England that was engaged in martial lockdown in the beginnings of war at that time. That came slightly after, but the principle still applies. He said, look, the southern colonies in Virginia, if you mention the word independence, they might just turn around and go back. So don't talk about independence. And in order to unite us, just give as much power as you can to Virginia. They're pretty, you know, self-superior, haughty, aristocratic types. So just let them lead. Don't try and take the lead if you want to unite the country. And ultimately, another fascinating piece of it, and this explains why constantly Virginia was given the lead in everything, as you began to say, Liz, the first president of the Continental Congress was a Virginian. George Washington was the first commander in chief. That has a lot to do with uniting the Southern and the other Northern or New England colonies. Another piece of this that is fascinating to me is to understand that George Washington was, in 1775, unanimously appointed as commander in chief. And we tend to think of the reason for that is this was just a phenomenal commander, a man of great sort of integrity within political circles, and he was fearsome on the battlefield. All that is true, but there's two other reasons why Washington was elected commander-in-chief of the Continental Army in 1775. And one we just touched on, he was a Southerner from Virginia. So in order to unite North and South, they wanted a Southern general. But the other piece that is less known is there was great fear at that time that if there was a dominant New England army led by a New England commander-in-chief, the fear was that the War of Independence would be won, and then you would have a power structure within the army led by New England, and what might happen next? There was rampant fear, clearly discussed, the evidence is robust, that Northern New England army, like led by a Cromwell figure, would make civil war upon the middle colonies and or the Southern colonies for reasons of simply for reasons of territorial imperialism. We forget that this was the age of imperialism, where one nation was somewhat expected, if they had the power and the might, to come into your territory and take your rivers, take your commerce, that it was standard of the day that imperialism took place. So George Washington was also elected commander-in-chief because it would help to prevent civil war between North and South.
One of the interesting things you write about in the book is John Adams recognizing his own prejudice as a New Englander. And you write, in Adams' political psychology, the prejudices lawmakers inherit from their parents and home communities were the worst poisons of politics and the greatest perils to the incipient American Union, especially when dissimilar peoples attempt to unite in a cooperative enterprise. He believed the only way out of conflict and paralysis was transcendence of prejudices, leading to sacrifice of interest and hard-fought compromise. This is actually something that I think would be very helpful today.
Real question, Hopeton, is how do we get that little piece of the book that you just described into the hands of roughly 500 political leaders in Washington, D.C., and have it brainwash them? I don't normally advocate brainwashing, but it is exactly the medicine that we need in our politics today. And it's exactly the medicine that, you know, John Adams was a cantankerous type, but I think he made the progress that he did. And I think he became the strong leader that he was because he had these built-in prejudices. I mean, he thought New England was far superior to any other part of the world, the religion, the political order, the social order. But he remarkably looked in the mirror and he recognized this phenomenon that you're describing of the prejudices and biases that we imbibe from birth. He actually said the problem is the mother's milk. And by that, he meant, what is the philosophy? What are the learnings? What are the prejudices and concepts and ideologies that we take in from our parents, from our mother's milk? And then we have to, the great challenge is that we have to hold on to some of that, but we also have to be able to transcend it in order to move humbly into a political sphere where I think this is the critical thing. And it might relate to the idea of when you're most passionate about something, we need to take a deep dive into history. Also, when you're most passionate about something, you have to reconcile. You have to recognize that is the moment where you have to find a way to collaborate. And as tough as it is, you just think you're so right about this issue, you have to compromise. So that's what politics is, obviously, is stubborn, hard-headed human beings who ultimately believe themselves in their mother's milk, et cetera. But at the end of the day, they have to meet the other side halfway. And that's hard for today for Democrats and, well, we know, especially for Republicans. So yes, transcendent of our own lesser base selves is, I think, the most important thing that all democracies need to do. And it's particularly urgent in ours today.
What does that say about the Daughters of the Confederacy who engaged in a campaign to retell the narrative of the Civil War, who had statues built of Civil War generals all over the South, and I guess some in the North, I'm not sure there. And so what we have is generation after generation of student over the past, I think that campaign began in earnest in the early 1900s or the late 1800s, who believed the glorious dignity of the Civil War based on the change of the narrative of the story of the Civil War from the Confederacy side.
Right. And you're bringing that up as a chronic, I guess, chronic and recurrent problem in our country, you know, takes us back to not my area of expertise, but an incredibly important, you know, moment or period of time in our history, which is Reconstruction and the failure of Reconstruction after the Civil War. It's like with a lot of history, it's fascinating to look back, and it's sort of what they call counterfactual considerations. But to look back, I really enjoy to look back at scenarios and wonder what could have been. But if somehow we had had the will and the way, perhaps if Lincoln had lived, the period of Reconstruction could possibly have survived. I mean, as you know, there was an incredible, very short period of a strong movement towards African-American equality that took place immediately after the Civil War, following the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But then the country allowed for a white supremacy to emerge, and the KKK, and it just all went south and backwards. So what I can say about today is it's very frightening and it's very dreadful what's happening in many regards, of course, with regard to the, in some ways, the loss of the Republican Party to the Republic. But I'm actually, we're at a new phase of civil rights, where you may know the book by Steve Phillips called How We Win the Civil War. It's incredible, one of the best books I've read in the past 4 or 5 years. And so we're looking at a future which is going to be beautiful, I think, which is a true multiracial democracy. There's a lot to be done to get there. But this backlash of systemic racism and white nationalism, that's the story of the country. It happened after Reconstruction and put an end to Reconstruction. As we know, it happened immediately after Brown versus the Board of Education, the civil rights movement. So we're fighting that again with some added peril, I think, with a demagogue like Trump leading the Republican Party. But I'm actually optimistic about the future, because that's where we're going. This country is a multiracial democracy. We just have to get the political power and the votes in proper order. And I believe we'll sustain the democracy. But if we lose it for some short period, we'll just have to fight and get it back.
Outside of your book, what book would you recommend to political leaders of today to read?
To read, what book today would I recommend they read and imbibe and believe in and follow?
Yes.
It would actually be a political friend of mine, literally a month or so ago, said to me, "You haven't read Steve Phillips' book, How We Win the Civil War?" And the subtitle is something akin to, you know, how we ultimately achieve a multiracial democracy and end white supremacy forever. It is a book that, among many other things, it just says, let's look at what Stacey Abrams did beginning in 2013 and ending in 2021 in Georgia, basically turned a red state blue. And there's a lot of important detail there and templates for how to do it. That is the book that's most on my mind. It has taken me from my realm of grave concern about the state of the rule of law in our country and the danger that demagogues tilting into authoritarianism represent in our countries, to really recognizing this is a second front, that the strategic understanding of where we can turn red districts or red states blue is the thing that's going to help us achieve a multiracial democracy. And in fact, I write a newsletter roughly weekly, sometimes only three per month, but on Substack called American Commonwealth. And this morning I released my second installment, basically, in some ways, it's a book review of Steve Phillips' book, but it really outlines this incredible phenomenon. I do think the method is there for how to, you say achieve, but it's really fulfill the multiracial democracy that currently exists in our country. The idea is the country is composed of 40% roughly of people of color, and then there are more than adequate, call them, liberal white allies who also believe in a multiracial democracy, easily puts us over the 50% mark. So that would be the book, again, How We Win the Civil War, that I would recommend, Hopeton.
Eli Merritt, author of Disunion Among Ourselves, The Perilous Politics of the American Revolution. This is an incredibly enlightening book that reminds us that the conflict we see today is really nothing new if you go back and read your history. Not sure if it was taught in school, but certainly it's something that we need to know and understand. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.